Hello, welcome to the Girl and Duck podcast. I'm Jen Storer, acclaimed children's book author and chief inspirationalist. That's not a term I made up. At girlandduck.com, creative writing, creative life. At Girl and Duck, I take you on a journey from exploring the art of kidlit creation right through to mastering the art of kidlit creation. To find out more about the courses and products that I offer, pop over to the website. You're bound to find inspiration and support and something to absolutely love over there. That's www.girlandduck.com. But in the meantime, stick around because we've got lots to talk about. Kate Whittle, welcome to Girl and Duck.
Hello.
Before we start, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which I live, work and play, and that is the Dja Dja Wurrung people, and to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which you reside, which we will talk more about as we go into the interview, and to pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Kate, I've been looking forward to this interview for the longest time. I wrote in the duck pond this morning that I was excited about grilling you.
Oh, no!
Because, you know, in all the years that we've known each other,
yeah, we
haven't really sat down and had a really good yak.
That's
you know, you've
true.
Been a moderator for us in the duck pond probably 6 years, I reckon.
I can't remember. It was a while. Yeah.
2016, I think we opened the pond, and you've been there mostly from the get-go, and then you became a moderator.
Yeah.
And then you just stayed with us and grown and evolved, and we've shared your journey. I've met you at book launches in person, but we've never really had a chance to chat.
No, because we're both so busy all the time doing different things. It's nice now to have that chance.
Yeah. And then you were at Duck Pond office hours a couple of months ago, and you know how office hours is really sort of intimate now. And
it's love office hours. Yeah, they work so well. Yeah. You get so much in such a short time.
Yeah. And so we can unmute, and then you were unmuted, and we had this great discussion, something technical about writing, and it was really, really interesting. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got to get Kate. I've got to get her and talk to her properly, so to share with more people. So thank you for coming along today. I really appreciate it.
No, I'm really excited to have this opportunity to have a chat with you. I love the duck pond. I'm forever telling people, jump in, join the duck pond. It's just so much.
That's cool.
And, yes, you've been so much for so many people over these years. You know, you really are. A role model and an inspiration and everything like that. So, it's lovely to have this opportunity.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm going to read your official bio just so everyone can get in the picture. And again, the thing I want to say about Kate Whittle from my perspective is I feel like you are a quiet achiever. You just get on with it, and you've been slowly building a body of work in the background with very little hoo-ha. But you've had so much experience in a lot of areas, and there's a lot I want to talk about. Anyway, let's just go with this bio first. So Kate Whittle writes for children and young adults. Her first book for young readers, Trouble at Home, about a girl and her troublesome dragon, was published by Omnibus Scholastic in 2016. More stories about trouble followed over the next couple of years, Trouble and the Missing Cat, then Trouble and the New Kid, which made the Notables list for the CBCA Book of the Year Awards in 2018. And the final book in the series, Trouble and the Exploding House. I love that title.
The one the kids love too.
Yeah, anything that explodes. A book about an accidental witch, Weird, spelt with a Y, for slightly older readers, was released in August 2018. And Kate's latest book, Emergency Rescue Angel, which I happen to have here, this gorgeous book, came out sadly in February 2020, just in time for the age of COVID, when we all needed a rescue angel, I've got to say. Kate lives in a beautiful rural valley in New South Wales, and if you follow her on Instagram, you'll see lots of gorgeous photos with her family and a whole host of wildlife that visit her backyard. Other than writing stories, she enjoys reading, going for walks in the rain, taking too many photographs, and pottering in the garden when she has time. Kate, who was a primary school teacher for close to 30 years, also loves to share her passion for stories with children and adults alike. So that's scraping the surface of the Kate Whittle story so far.
Yes, yes.
As I said, you've got all these books under your belt and all this experience. And I want to talk to you more about that. I want to talk to you about your writing process as well. But Kate, can we, as I always do, can we go back to the beginning? Because the other thing I know about you is that you had a pretty fascinating childhood. Could you share with us where you were born and then where you ended up and why you ended up there and how you ended up in Australia? Can we go through that little...
Yeah, I can. I think you have to understand, first of all, that I think my father was a bit of a gypsy. He was... he always wanted to travel. He still does, but unfortunately the age he is, he can't travel around as much. But when I was young, we just moved a lot and I loved it. It was an amazing lifestyle. I was actually born in Nigeria back in the long ago. And my father was a teacher, so he was teaching English to the people who were going to take over the administration when Britain... returned independence to Nigeria. So that was his job, and he worked in several different parts of Nigeria. I was born in a place called, or we lived in Zaria, which is basically out bush, or it was then. I don't know what it's like these days. My mother was very brave because most of the colonials, as we were back then, went back to the UK to have babies, but I was actually born in Nigeria, and I'd love to go back one day because I've heard so many amazing stories and I've got so many pictures, but I've never had that opportunity, and it's a little bit of a scary place, I think, to visit, but I would love to go there.
It was quite beautiful. So how old were you when you left Nigeria?
I was still a baby. It was coming up to the time when they were handing over, and my father's contract was sort of coming to an end. He was working with the government over there. He was a government teacher, not a missionary teacher. So we went back to England, where I lived in Cornwall for a while, and kind of loved the idea of Cornwall. It's a,
it just gets better, doesn't it?
But unfortunately, everybody else wanted to live in Cornwall too. So we soon found ourselves moving further along the south coast, and my earliest memories probably come from when we lived in Dorset. And we lived, first of all, in Dorchester, which is the county town. And you might have heard of it in Thomas Hardy's works. And yes. Then we lived in a beautiful little place called Bridport, where I started school. It was my first school memories, and they were a bit interesting. And then we went to North Africa, and I lived in North Africa for a while.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So how old were you when you went from the cosy shores of England to North Africa? That's another sort of drama.
Oh, it is. It's and I have to say I loved it. It was beautiful over there. We lived in Tripoli in Libya.
Yeah.
My father was working with one of the big oil companies, again, teaching English to the people who were working for them, the locals. And my memories of Tripoli are just brilliant blue skies and golden sands, Mediterranean sunsets, huge, amazing electrical storms. And,
it's almost like a Gerald Darrell story.
it was a beautiful place, and we had some fabulous holidays. We drove along the top of the coast to Tunisia and spent some time in Tunis, and oh my goodness, Leptis Magna, the huge Roman ruins right on the coast. Just a gorgeous place to be. I used to stand at the top of the amphitheater and imagine that I was part of the crowd watching. I was always rooting for the animals and the Christians rather than the Romans. it was a good fun thing to spend your childhood doing, and I probably fell in love with history at that point in my life. Yeah.
So, and also then, of course, later on going on to become a teacher, kind of following a bit in Dad's footsteps.
So
from there, from North Africa, then how you came back to England again, did you?
Yes, we did via Malta. We stayed in Malta for a while.
Okay.
Then we were back in England, and we started out back in Dorset, but we moved up to Shropshire, which is my spiritual home, right on the border of Wales. And, you know, I often have conversations with Rhiannon, who has close to home. She's in Wales is her spiritual place, and my place is right on the border, dragons and castles and all that deep mysterious stuff. And I lived in Shrewsbury, or a little villages around the outside of Shrewsbury, and then we came to Australia.
You came to Australia with your family of origin?
Yes, I did.
As an adult, right?
In my early teens, though.
Okay.
So I actually went to high school in Kiama.
In Kiama? Oh yes. My goodness. Okay. Wow.
And
that's on the Murray, isn't it?
No, Kiama's right down on the south coast. Wollongong and goes south.
Oh, right, yeah.
So loved it down there. Grew up on surf beaches, and that might make a little bit more sense.
it's got a really strong sense of place, this book. Strong sense of place. It's beautiful. So you went to high school in there, and then from there...
Yeah, I left home 17 to go to university in Canberra.
In Canberra.
Where I studied history. Woohoo! In fact, I got crazy and did medieval studies for years and years and years. I've done graduate studies as well. Totally pointless in Australia because I did Western Europe and Britain and things like that. But just totally immersed in that whole scene. So I've done Old English and Middle English done all kinds of things like that. And then I became a primary school teacher, because when I went to high school to teach, I just couldn't teach in a situation where I didn't have the people around me with the same sort of passion. And a lot of the kids were sort of saying, oh, why do we have to do this? And I thought, you know, it's probably a reasonable question to ask, why do we have to do this? And then I went to primary school where it was much more fun.
And you were a teacher for nearly 30 years.
Yes, I was. So I wasn't in the classroom the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But still, you're in that world for that long.
Yeah.
And so through all this, Kate, when did your desire to write, I'm sure you were probably writing all along, but to, you know, write formally or to, you know, get published, those sorts of things, when did that really kick in?
Well, like many people, when I was young, the only thing I wanted to do was write. This was my thing. I was going to be an author when I grew up. I haven't grown up yet, so I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up, but that was all I wanted to do. And other people were thinking about whether they were going to be teachers or, you know, doctors or lawyers or fire officers. I was still saying, oh, I'm going to be an author. But I basically had that thing where the vocational guidance people said, oh, that's not a real job. And so I don't know. I did submit my first novel, completed novel, when I was 21 to I think it was Pan Macmillan, or it might have just been Pan. And they wrote me back a beautiful letter which basically said, go away and live and then come back later. And
go away and live?
You know, get some life experience.
Oh, my goodness.
And I look back and it was a dreadful novel. They had every right to go away. But I also realised later how lovely they'd been because they'd written me a letter saying, you know, that my writing skills were okay. I just needed to have a bit more experience in life. Yeah. I look back now and I see some other people who've been published as very young people. I think it's not there, but as I said, it was a terrible novel. I'm glad they didn't publish it, because it's not where I would like to be anyway. And then, you know, life took over, as it does, and I would write and I would not really do very much. But I've got what a lot of people like to call a two-tier family. My first two children I had very young, and then my third came along in, you know, I don't know, some sort of midlife crisis. And I took time off because she's beautiful. She's a high-need baby from the very beginning. And I started writing seriously again while I was home when in those, you know, little moments, those little cracks when I had time. And I entered a competition and I was published in a little anthology. And that was the start of me thinking, yes, I can do this. I can actually do this. And I went to the Writers' Centre and I learned things.
In Canberra, the ACT.
Yeah, the ACT Writers' Centre.
You physically went there? You physically went along to?
Yes. I don't know what it's like in other states. I would assume it's the same. But they would have people coming in, authors who would tell their life story and would you know, just teach how to do different things. I was very eclectic. I collected any author that came along. I'd go and see what they were doing. I joined Squibby too, SCBWI, which was at that point in Canberra. I think there were maybe five of us would turn up to meetings. Five every time. But we'd go to that. And I belonged to the speculative fiction group there, who were all very accomplished writers, and I felt like a bit of an interloper, but I learned a lot. And I got published with one of their anthologies as well, which was more of a YA sort of story that I wrote. So I kind of just built and took everything from everywhere. This is dinosaur days before the internet.
Just chipping away at it.
Away. And I love learning. It's kind of just one of those things, and I collect information. I'm a collector of little bits and pieces here, there and everywhere. And in the midst of all this, I was writing an epic novel, which I would pull off the shelves over there, but it's like two big thick things like this put together. It's over it's nearly 150,000 words.
Okay.
And in a fit of, I don't know, something amazing, I decided to enter it in it was called the Terry Pratchett First Novel Award, Anywhere But Here, Any When But Now.
Right.
And I entered in that competition and I was shortlisted from an international field. I was of five people. Out of, I don't know, over 500 entries. And it's never been published.
That must have been a huge boost to your confidence.
It was. And I often say it's kind of like a catalyst. And a couple of things happened in quick succession. I'd been writing other things too, and I'd written my first draft of the first Trouble book. And I'd been submitting that around without much success because I don't really think I knew what I was doing still. I mean, I'd learned the skills of writing, but there are other skills that you sort of pick up on as you go, which is about how you submit, how you connect with publishers and things like that. And it's an ever-changing landscape. But I'd seen two things. I'd seen at that time Deanne Blacklock was doing a blog for Omnibus, which was called On Ya Bus, which was lovely. And she said something in one of her blogs which resonated with me. And at exactly the same time, I think it was Marcus Zusak had written a blog where he said, when you approach publishers, be real. Give them some personality. Don't just do the whole very formal letter. And I've been thinking, I'm always very formal. I was very polite and very formal. And so I wrote this submission to Deanne, which was all full of friendly, you know, it's me, not this terrible business person. And I sent her the first three chapters and she got back to me and said, I'd like to see the rest. So I sent it off. And then I went to England to meet Terry Pratchett and to go to the award ceremony.
I see that on your website, by the way.
I know.
Here on the other computer, and there's a photo of you and Terry Pratchett together. That must have been extraordinary.
Oh, fangirling like nobody's business. I love Terry Pratchett's Discworld novels, and I read them to death. And he was such an intelligent, clever person. And they're all satire, they're all humour.
Yeah.
And to have had him read my novel, not just a few pages, but he read the whole thing, was like, he read my novel.
Yeah.
He read my novel.
My life.
And I know he did. Because when we had that chat, he was saying, you could do this at this part, and that was fabulous, and I really loved it. So he'd read it. I knew it wasn't just one of those things. I was so excited, but I came second. There was a young man who really was showing incredible, you know, his talent for writing in a modern fantasy genre was really amazing. So I came second, but I met Terry Pratchett. It gave me an enormous sense of confidence. So when I came back and I'd heard nothing more from Deanne Blacklock, and I went along to the Writers' Centre where I met Elisa Darlison, who is another amazing mentor figure in my life. And we went to lunch together when everybody else disappeared. There was just me and Elisa standing there. I said, oh, well, let's go and get lunch. And I had the opportunity to chat, and she said, oh, just contact her. I was doing the whole thing, if you don't hear back, then just forget it. And she said, just contact her. And she said, oh, yes, I saw that. No, yes, please send it again. And that was it. I sent in the manuscript again. And there was a lot of rewriting. It went from being 16,000 words long to 10,000 words. A lot of tightening up, some fabulous editing with Celia Jellett. And working with Celia was amazing. It was kind of like we were on the same page the whole time. It was amazing. And then my little book, where is it? There it is. Finally,
they're gorgeous. The shells. They're really, really pretty.
And I had the
They've
other
got a little tashy feel about them, haven't they? I reckon.
Sorry? Oh, yes. Well, that was the other thing. Having the first one illustrated by Kim Gamble was like, oh, I was fangirling again. It was an amazing thing. But, you know, sadly he was not able to do any more than that because he had cancer and was approaching the end of his life.
Yeah.
But he sort of handed over to Stephen Michael King, who he'd mentored. And,
I see.
So
he just picked up the aesthetic really.
You can see that that's Kim Gamble, that's Stephen Michael King, but you can see that he's worked hard to try and keep the same.
Absolutely.
Same sense. So
yeah,
that was the other three in the series were all illustrated by.
And they're they've got black and white artwork inside.
They're all the way through. They're beautiful little junior fiction novels. There's 12 chapters.
Yeah,
and there you go, some pictures.
Yeah,
it's a bit hard from here.
Yeah. And when it's on the podcast, people are going, oh, whatever. One thing I just wanted to backtrack a little bit to, Kate, too, for those who are listening who are, you know, emerging authors, what I really admire about you recalling that story for us too is that you had to go from you know when the book went in it was 16,000 words and you had to bring it down to 10, which is quite, that is a massive unpicking, and it's also a massive unpicking for someone who's not skilled in that area yet. So I really admire that, and I want to flag that again. I know I say it all the time, but one of the skills of being an author is learning to write under direction. Learning to rewrite under direction, and that can bring a lot of people undone. So do you have any tips around that? Like, even if you just say, well, I just wanted it so badly, I did it, or what? How did you confront that? How did you take that challenge on?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a mindset challenge. And I know that it's easy to get precious about your work and want it to be just so. But I thought several things. One, I'm working with industry professionals who know what they're doing. So, first of all, to take their advice seemed like the most sensible direction, you know, that, and they knew that the 16,000 words was too long for junior fiction, and the story just wasn't a middle grade or anything like that. It's definitely that high-end junior fiction, so 7 to 10 year olds. It was straightforward. We wanted 10,000. There was no take it out a little bit. I had a very specific goal, target, and I knew that, well, Diane wanted me to do that. I think an important part of it is to show that I was willing. So I actually did that editing before I signed the contract.
Okay, which is, again, I flagged that. That's very common with first-time authors, yeah, and first-time contracts. And, again, it's about the publisher and the editor not consciously putting you to the test, but they are watching and waiting and hoping that you'll come through.
Well, I think this is the thing. And I had lots of encouragement. There was nothing, you know, horrible about it. I had lots of encouragement. They wanted the story, but I think it's really, really important to realise you're part of a team. You've created the story. That's fine. You've sort of been the catalyst for this book coming into the world, but then you're not alone. You've got your publishers, you've got your editors, you've got your illustrators, you've got the book designers, the marketing people. It's a team, and you're just one little cog in the wheel. And I think it's a very privileged cog, to, if you know what I mean. I feel, yeah, to me, to see my name on a book for the first time was just like amazing. And anybody, I'm sure, who has been there and has actually finally reached that goal would say to you, first time is always, it's just a very special moment. And so, you know, I'm just part of the team. I'm doing that I have been asked to do. I want it. I desperately want it. If you remember, I said from a very little girl, I always wanted to be an author. And by then I'd been in lots of different anthologies. I'd written for magazines, short stories, and also articles. I'd been commissioned a few times by the Pearson magazines to do some articles and things like that. So I was getting my feet. I was doing my apprenticeship. I was working towards, I don't know, the 10,000 hours or whatever it is that brings you to a stage where you can start to say, I can do this.
Yeah.
And so when I approached the actual process, I had, I think at that point, 10 chapters, and I went through and I re-established where I would want the 12 different things to be and start. And I literally gave myself a target of cutting down each chapter to, I think it's about 800 words, a little bit over 800.
So you're very methodical about it.
Yeah, I thought it was easier to approach it as a step block process.
Mm.
And I did do it all in one go. You can't do it all in one go. You start and you take so many out and you put some in.
Yeah.
Because as you take things out, you have to be able to make everything continue to flow. So it comes out, it goes in, you come back, you take more out, you take more out. And eventually I think, you know, my brain was going crazy, but I finally reached close to that. I think I literally did that whole thing where I have now got exactly 10,000 words. And I sent it back to Diane, and she sent me the contract, which also included 3 more books.
That must have been very exciting.
That would be, yeah, and it was an amazing thing. It was a lot easier to write the next 3 books knowing that
I was going to say, and so now you had like a template, and yeah, going forward you knew that the next 3 books had to be 10,000 words each and how, yeah, many chapters. Yeah, right, yeah.
Did you have
other stories sort of outlined at that way back at that point, or did they say, hey, this is a series, off you go and write some more?
Well, I had outlined some possibilities that I thought, you know.
And did you put those in the
standalone story, but if you're interested, these other things, okay, could be part of it. I had a quick synopsis, a pitch,
okay, if you like. That was in your pitch. Good.
Yeah.
but you had given it a little bit of thought. And it, and do you think that was part of what sold it?
I think so. And I think the fact that there was that choice that it could be standalone or it could be part of a series gave that flexibility and also the opportunity for them to decide, you know, where they saw it fitting in the market.
Yeah.
And I had more than the three options, and we talked between us about which ones we would continue with.
And at what rate did they publish them?
So they were published 6 months apart over 2 years.
Okay.
And I think it probably took about 18 months from the final draft to the first publication.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it wasn't a quick process, and that would have gone, and I was editing with Celia and things were sort of in process, and then I was also working on the others, which, you know, they were a lot quicker. And I think it's one of those things, though, you know, you have this idea in your head, you know what you're doing, but I'm not really a strong planner. I know where I'm going, I know where I'm starting, and everything else is a bit of a surprise as I write. And I think I went through a process of trying to work out what kind of a planner I was. And I've actually done courses teaching other people different ways of planning because I think different things work for different people. But for me, it was I had this little paragraph that I'd given, and of course, in the midst of all this, Omnibus was subsumed back into Scholastic.
Mm-hmm.
So Deanne left, and I was working with Claire, and Claire had her own imprint on the whole thing too.
With Claire Halifax?
Claire Halifax, yes, sorry. Yep. She was a wonderful person to work with quite closely, in actual fact, because her industry knowledge is unparalleled, I think, and just to have that there as an option was just... Yeah. I bet you were relieved
when you... Because, you know, this is a very scary thing, super scary thing, to lose a publisher or editor mid-project for the author is absolutely kind of terrifying, because you don't know who you're going to be handballed to and if you're going to have a rapport with them or...
Exactly. And I know that some projects were just cancelled.
That's
so
right.
I didn't realise at the time, but it was one of the things that was going through my head that we would, that would all finish. And I'd just broken through.
Yeah.
I was one of the lucky, was the fortunate ones who they kept working with. And I'm still working with Scholastic. I have two little books with them at the moment.
Okay. Great.
Will hopefully come out in the next couple of years.
And are they junior fiction again? Or
junior fiction again.
And are they, you say, so there's two of them, did you say?
Yes.
And are they part of the same story or are they different books?
They are, what we're hoping is it will be the beginning of a series, but if it's not, the two will follow each other and it will be, that will be it.
Okay.
They're what I call very high investment books from Scholastic, because they're long form picture books.
Oh, wow.
So there's
that's exciting. I mean, look at that. Another form that you're working in, another genre.
Yes, yeah.
And it's wow.
Very exciting.
I wrote the initial
draft in the same format as the Trouble books. And submitted to Claire, and she had this amazing vision, and I don't know how many hours we spent on the phone talking, and then there was huge editing again, cutting down, cutting out, to create from that one novel, short novel, these two picture books. And
that's a great story. I'll look forward to that, seeing them come out.
I can't wait.
Yeah. And that's next year, did you say, 2023?
I'm thinking it might actually head over into the 24 now, because just the time because of COVID, bless it, everything slows down.
Like, as if publishing is not exactly, you know, a racehorse at the best of times.
No,
an old nag, really. With one limp leg, you know. So,
we'll get there eventually.
It's very normal to talk in terms of 2 years, 3 years when it comes to
publishing. Yes, it is. And especially
now, of course, So, of course, in this, you've lost Claire.
I have. I know. And it's
so Claire's now gone to Walker.
She's gone to Walker. And I feel slightly bereft. I really do. But I've got, there are two other publishers with Scholastic who I'm dealing with at the moment. Yes. And we're still in the building the relationship stage, I think, but so busy. It's such, they're absolutely flat out at Scholastic.
And it would take a lot for a publisher or editor to get their head around an already established project, I would imagine, you know, to find the inroads and to, you know, to gather up the nuances and be in a position to advise you with some sort of authority and,
And what I'm finding at the moment, we've done a little bit of rewriting and I'm waiting to hear back at the moment because I think they have to have that buy-in as well. Mm. You know, they're looking at how that will fit their publishing list. And so there's little, you know, we've got to juggle a bit for a few months or whatever until we work out exactly what we're doing. But
are you at liberty to talk much about this before I go any further? Because I just wanted to say, have they employed an illustrator yet? Do you know?
And there is an illustrator, and I'm really, 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 really excited by who it is.
You can't tell us
yet. I'm not sure I'm allowed to say.
I don't want to put you in that position, and you know, and then. That's good though that you're happy.
I cannot wait to see what this illustrator comes up with. Honestly, I'm really, really excited because I love their work.
And that's just so great. So great. What are we up to? 11:06. Gosh, we're going really well, but you know, there's just still so much I want to talk to you about. Now, can I just do I'm just getting up your website again, putting in my stupid password, which I always forget. because what I discovered on your website, which is so cool. Now, I knew that you were up to other things. I knew that you were, because we've been in things together and, you know, and I knew that you were sort of, for want of a better word, creating some kind of side hustle or at least exploring the option of having a side hustle. And so then I come to your website and I find under resources, it's a drop-down menu and you go to writers, and you are building up something really gorgeous there.
Oh.
Now, one thing I want to say, I did not know that you offer manuscript assessments. How did I not know that? I feel like Dory out of Number 96, you know. Why wasn't I told? So I'm thrilled that you're doing that because it's a thing that I'm always looking for great, you know, manuscript assessors that I can really trust and that I can refer people to. And I had no idea that you're offering that. So I'll flag that with you. I want to talk to you about that. I also want to say to you that I want to see more of this in the Duck Pond, especially in Marketing Monday. You know, I would love to see you marketing this in the Duck Pond more and get some visibility in there too. That would be really, really precious to us all because we all love you. Like, who wouldn't want to get a manuscript assessment from you? So that's really cool. But then if I click on another thing, your website's so pretty, by the way, totally, totally pretty. You're going to be offering the Writer's Journey Roadmap coming soon. It's in development. And you're also working up workshops and mini retreats. There's all sorts of things going on here. So could you fill us in on this part of the adventure?
Well, this is my you know, my retirement relaxation. I love teaching. It's always been a big central part of me, and I was just trying to find different ways to to teach, because you can log in anywhere and there's all sorts of things available that you can just do a short course here and a short course there. And I feel like I don't want to do the same thing, because there are people doing amazing things. I mean, I tell everybody all the time about your courses, Jen. I've done, I think it was the junior fiction one with you, because I just was so excited and things like that. And the picture book one, I haven't done the middle grade one with you, and I was thinking I might actually pop into that. I don't know, because it's just lovely to see other people's way of doing things. But I wouldn't try to do the same thing, because I know that there's stuff out there and there are people who are doing it really well, like you. So I thought, how else can I present that? And the roadmap, I was thinking, would be more like a sort of group mentorship.
So I see here a cross between a mentorship and a power critique group.
Yeah. So this is what I thought, that it would go over, I don't know, a period of time. I haven't actually finalized it, because life has got a bit hectic for one reason or another. And I had this great plan. It would go over a period of time. We would go through the different steps that you need to plan and prepare and edit, and then, you know, submit how you can go through, but do it as in a group setting. I'm thinking of using, I think it's called Circle, which is a different online community setup. And then,
so is that like is that similar to a Zoom where people?
Yeah, you can use Zoom inside it. So Circle becomes the community. And then, so everything is in one place. You've got your social media, you've got your groups and your breakout groups. You can have pre-recorded and live sessions. And I just think it looks to me to be very flexible in that regard. I'm just learning it a little bit at the moment. And my thought was that I would open that up for a small group as a pilot group at a reasonable, you know, hopefully. See, that's the other thing that worries me. Sometimes it all gets a bit too costly to go in and do things. So, I mean, I want to make it affordable. I want to make it worth my while. So I've got to sort of balance those two things.
It's a massive challenge. It's a massive challenge. And, you know, but for all women in particular, and you can pin me up for saying that, but you know, it is a big thing. Pricing is a big issue for women, and you're giving value, and you need to get value in return. It's fair. But how do we arrive at that price? It's very challenging for women, and a lot of demons arc up and a lot of conditioning
arcs up
under that. Yeah, that's why it's, you know, business for women is such a boot camp in personal development.
It is because, you know, I think we're socialized from a very early age not to put ourselves forward, no matter. And I'm sort of in that generational where we've gone through so much transition that there's still that programming from the early years to say, you know, step back. It's not your role to stand up. It's not your role to be seen.
And it's certainly not your role to charge.
Yes. You could be doing everything for the love.
Exactly, because you're a good girl.
Yes, because you're a good girl. See, and that's precisely, I was just going to say, I read this amazing analysis of Red Riding Hood the other day about, you know, how that's all about staying on the path and doing the right thing. And I thought, oh my goodness, I am Red Riding Hood and I want to be so, yes.
Kate, we could go down the Red Riding Hood path here, couldn't we? Maybe we need to have another interview about this kind of thing, because in my other community just yesterday I recorded a video and I got on a rant on about Practical Magic, the film with Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman, which I adore. I love Practical Magic. But my God, there's some issues there in terms of patriarchy and conditioning.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful when you pull things like that apart and see the subliminal messages that are coming through from platforms like Hollywood. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It's
right down to us. As,
absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. But, so this is super exciting, Kate. I'm totally behind you all the way for this. Cannot wait. There's so much space out there for more writers. Sorry, I'm putting my password in again because I love looking at this website. More writers out there to be doing these side hustles and getting something from it, but also giving to the community and building communities and fostering talent that's out there in a structured way.
We have to rely on each other. We have to be a community, because otherwise you're out there on your own. It's a very isolating choice of, you know, the way you spend your life. So unless you become part of a community, unless you share your journey with other people and hold each other up, it's so important to hold each other up, you can end up in a very lonely place, I think.
I think so. I think so. That's sort of something that I became aware of further into my career, was that feeling that maybe one day I'd get to the point and that, you know, I looked back and go, well, what was that all about?
Yeah.
It was just me.
Yeah. Well, so, like,
what was that
what
all
am I doing
about?
Here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and that's one of the things I've loved about the Duck Pond. And I mean, I dived in, boots and all, right at the very beginning, just because having that connection with other people,
so
and
vital.
Knowing that you were with like minds and everybody was loving and supporting each other was just, it's just so important. It's a really valuable place to be.
Yeah. And I think there needs to be more written and shared out there about mental health for writers and illustrators. Oh my God. Yeah, because there isn't enough. I think we've been seen ourselves and been sort of subtly instructed to be some kind of pack horse within the industry, and it's not healthy. And that's cracking open now, and people are starting to see it's not healthy, and there are other ways of being.
And I think that to be able to take that step from the writer in the garret, the lonely, slightly mad person, into being part of a vibrant, that's what I'm looking for, a vibrant community is really important. And it's things, little things that are starting to happen, like, when I'm talking about my book being a picture book, it's not going to be my book, it's going to be our book. Because the story is shared by the person who's doing the illustrating. So I'm so tired of the fact that you can see people say, you know, this, the author of this picture book, but who's the illustrator? And we need to sort of start to share all that and to be able to say, well, my book came about because I was able to work with all these different people. I'm part of a team. I'm not this lonely person in a garret, and I'm part of a community that has held me up and pushed me forward and, you know, caught me when I'm drowning. And we all drown. Sometimes we're all in need of that.
Absolutely.
That support.
Definitely. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, other jobs, other careers have communities around them. So, And you know, it used to be that writers only really saw other writers, and that would be at events like once every couple of years, you know, like a conference or something, and then you scuttle back to your room.
That's right, shut the door and tuck away.
Yeah. So being in this position, in this modern age, you know, with this technology where everyone can link up and build their own little types of communities, that's the other thing. I mean, there's lots of different types of communities all within the same industry.
Absolutely.
Meeting different needs, yeah.
And I think
splinter groups, you know, there's splinter groups. Duck Pond has splinter groups and people going off, you know, doing things. It's really cool.
And the great thing is, if you find that one isn't working for you, if it's not the right place, if you don't feel valued there, it's easy to step aside and find another one.
Yeah, because
I mean, I think back even to the very I have to laugh because the very first anthology I was in was launched by a very well-known writer and gorgeous person who stood up afterwards and said, "What a wonderful outlet for people who wouldn't be published any other way." And there was a group of, we were all there at the launch, the different people in the anthology, and I think we all went, "What? We want to be published some other way." And formed my first critique group from that group of people who all felt slightly dissed.
Inhaled at the same time.
We're all going, "What? This isn't just, this isn't the beginning." And I think being part of that critique group was the first social experience I had as a writer, and they're still very, very important to me, all of those people that we worked together for years and we tried to do things together and be a community. But this is in the days before the internet. There's no Facebook. There was no nothing like that. I sometimes think, you young writers, you've got it all. But I guess there's also many, many more distractions. But I sit there thinking, becoming part of a community right in the very beginning, and we would meet every week and we'd share what we, not every week, sorry, every month, and we would share what we'd been writing, and we'd be back and forth on the very old-fashioned emails, which had very little whatever. But today, you know, we're here, we're face to face, it's so dynamic, we can can practically contact anybody at any stage.
And the other thing too about the veil, you know, the veil slipping, you know, and we're seeing people as people, you know, they're not their roles anymore. They're, you know, so all that mystique, you know, a little bit of mystique is a good thing, but too much mystique is very isolating and doesn't get anyone anywhere. So, so to get to know everyone in the industry on some level of intimacy.
Yeah.
Not just the authors and illustrators, but also the designers. I was a designer bowled up to me once at a book launch. I didn't know her. I'd never seen her, but she was so excited to meet me because she designed one of my books. It was so lovely to talk face to face to someone like that who's normally behind the scenes. But but also to get to know the publishers and editors.
And yes, and to know that we're all people.
We're all people.
We're not these I don't know, some kind of mystical entity hidden behind some locked door.
No, and not the Wizard of Oz.
It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then you start to realise, you know, that you're talking about designers, that they have their own whole industry focus happening in the background too. And I know that the person who did this one, Weird. It's very pink, but I love it.
Great cover. Great
they're,
cover.
They're award winners in, you know, you sit there going, "Oh, you never think of that. You never think of a designer." Yeah. Or I didn't at that point, and now I do. I sort of.
And again, that's part of the mystique and of the industry, you know, the veil dropping and us getting to appreciate how many hands and how many brains and how much energy is involved in creating a book.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
exactly.
So it's great.
As I say, Kate,
So, Kate, I'm really super excited about where you're heading with this, and I hope that we'll see more about it and that it starts to fall into place for you as life gets back into balance again.
Just like the balance out.
Yeah. But good for you for creating this. So how are you going to put it out there? Do you have a newsletter or
I do. I have a newsletter which I'm currently – getting out once a month, the beginning of the month,
and
I try to keep. It's very long. I always
tell people if people want to know about your upcoming services, it would it be advisable for them to get on your mailing list?
Yes, yeah, because then, as I'm doing things, I will put in there. At the moment, like I said, I had to go on the back burner for a little while with getting all that started because of. Just a few different changes in my life circumstances. Increase in the caring role that all women seem to end up with. But And it's a role that I appreciate, but I also realise that it means that I'm slightly less flexible than I thought I would have been having stopped work. But, yes, it's all stuff that I'm pulling together. I have my newsletter, which I send out once a month.
And, so we just go to your website and we look for the sign-up.
There's a newsletter sign-up. And that's katelittle.com. At the bottom of every page, I think it's down there. So you can just click on sign up. It's actually a growing list at the moment, and it's lovely because I've had people contacting me by email or through the contact page and talking to me about what's going into the newsletter. So it's starting to feel a lot more interactive.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a lot more like I'm conversing with people and less like I'm just putting stuff on
into
the
void. Oh, that's great. That's really good. Yeah. And this is just once again, I will put all these links down at the bottom, but just for people listening, and it'll be Kate Whittle katewhittle.com. Is that your
website? It's katewhittlewrites.com.
Oh, okay. Katewhittlewrites.
Katewhittlewrites. And I've got an email link and or a contact page on there. But if people want to email me directly, it's kate@katewhittlewrites.com.
Okay, all right, so we'll put all those put all those links down below. Oh no, it's exciting times, Kate, and really fun to watch you evolve and grow. Super excited about these new books coming out with Scholastic.
Yes.
And such an interesting format, and a format that lots of people over the years have asked me about, and I'm pretty clueless about the long form PB, so it'll be all eyes on you at that time, I think, when that comes out, because it's sort of it feels like I don't know, a new opportunity for people.
I think it is. I think that there's as I said, I think it's a high investment experiment for Scholastic, but it's interesting because, you know, going back to my own childhood, I remember picture books being a lot longer and a lot more involved, with a lot more opportunity to build the narrative, if you like. So I suppose in a way it's cycling back, but it's still a lot more, it's a lot tighter, I think, than those great long picture books that we had when I was tiny.
But, I remember them. No, it's very, very interesting.
I think it is another opportunity, and I think if it takes off, there are people who will jump at the opportunity.
Absolutely, absolutely, So you're a bit of a trailblazer there.
Oh, I'm not. I'm not the first. I'm not the first, but I'm jumping in early. No.
But it's not a common thing, and it's a really cool thing to have had. And going forward, any other novels in the pipeline? Any other things that you're thinking about?
Oh yes, I have. Pardon me. I have another book which has just been acquired by StoryTorch Press, which will be coming out in April next year. I'm very excited about that one.
And which that's a novel?
It's a middle grade adventure. It's solar punk. So I'm aiming a little bit off to the left or right, of, don't know which way, of my fantasy magic realism. But it's a set in the future, a solar punk future, and I'm looking forward to doing that. Working with Sam Rutter at StoryTorch will be lovely. Yes, and there are always things in the wings. I've got another middle grade that I'm editing at the moment that I'm hoping to find a home for. I ran it past Claire Halifax. It was a little bit too much fantasy for Scholastic, so I'll probably be spreading my wings a little bit to find a different publisher with that one. I've got an adult novel, which I have to be careful because somebody told me I can't call it an adult novel because everybody then thinks it's a particular an adult for grown-ups. but that one's also finished and needs some work, but yeah, I've got a few things.
Kate, can I ask you one question on the back of all that that's asked all the time around the traps? How do you juggle multiple projects at the same time, and how do you make choices about which one you're going to work on and which one you're going to finish?
Choices is the thing, isn't it? Because when you have so many things vying for your attention, it can become very paralyzing. You can, in fact, end up sitting there going, I can't do anything because I don't know what to work on. I have to say, I tend to be, I think, what do they call it, a serial monogamist. So I will focus in on one thing for a length of time, and then I'll maybe put that on one side to brew, is what I like to call it, to let the magic grow, and I'll work on something else. And often that might be decided by deadlines. For instance, I finally got the novel for grown-ups finished because I decided I wanted to enter it in a particular competition, which turned out to be a really bad fit. But at the time, that was, I think it's a changing idea of language inside the publishing industry. They said commercial fiction, and that's what I thought I'd written was commercial fiction. And then when I looked at the prize winners, they were a lot more literary. So I'm thinking that we have to be a bit more careful about how we interpret the language that's being used. So it was probably the wrong thing to put into that competition, but I still feel it's something that has, you know, purpose, a place. And but I got it finished because of that deadline, and now I can spend a little bit more time going back and having another look at it, because having given it that time, I realised that there are things that I would like to tighten up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think deadlines are a great thing. You have a look and you see which is coming first. I'll work on that now. So that helps. But I also think you've got to feel the love for whatever you're working on at any given time. If you're plodding away and it isn't working, I think it's fair to let it rest for a bit. And I know that we have the muddy middles and we have to climb through them, and we do get our feet wet going through that swamp. But just sometimes I think it works to say, okay, I've reached this point, and if I keep going, I'm just going to fall out of love with this.
Mm.
And I think rest it, work on something else. And I often find, I don't know, my brain sparks in 20 different directions. I think I'm reasonably certain I'm ADHD for various reasons. But I find if I can't grab the spark, then I won't be able to keep going with something. And I've got things really in my bottom drawer.
Really good advice, Kate. I think that's really, it's about holding on to the passion and the love. And then, and also feeling confident and reassured that the passion and the love does wax and wane.
Yeah,
it will come back. You know, you don't. I say to people, you know, if you're feeling a loss of the love mid project, it's safe to leave it be, because that love will probably come back.
Yeah,
you know, trust that it will come back, and you'll be revived and re-energized, and then you can take on the enormous challenge of that book again. Yeah.
And you may be surprised when something sparks again.
Yeah.
Often it's when you're not thinking about it, when you've let something go, and one day you'll be out walking or driving or in a shopping centre, or something will just click and everything will fall into place and you can't wait to get back.
Back.
And start work on that again. Yeah. And I had a funny one for a little while. Which probably sounds silly. I was writing a book which has ravens in it, and I have bird visitors to my garden every day. I love them, I adore them, but the ravens are not common visitors. And for a little while I had a raven coming to visit me every day, telling me off, go back, write some more, go back, write some more. And I swear that I had like a little totem for a while coming in to keep me going on a story. And I did get it finished and the raven disappeared. And at the moment I've just noticed ravens back in my front back garden at the moment. I'm thinking, okay, it's time to take that one out and do a bit more.
Wow, that's gorgeous.
Because it's a completed novel. I just need to finish the tightening up.
I love that. I was actually going to say, and then I thought it might have sounded a bit too woo, but now you've gone there. You know, I do believe that the universe gets involved in writing stories. You know, the universe is at its core creativity. It's the creative force. And so I feel that it does on some level get involved in the creation of stories, and it's a breadcrumb trail. And, you know, you get those breadcrumbs and you don't necessarily get them to order. You know, some of them you have to wait for, but they do come. The little signs and signals away along the way, and the little aha moments. And as you say, they often come when we let go and
leave things to trust.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Kate, this has been a gorgeous conversation. I've loved getting to know you a little bit better. It's we've been everywhere, all around the world.
Yeah.
Down and round and round. But I want to thank you so much for coming along today and for sharing all this with us, and just looking forward to everything that's coming from the Kate Whittle pen and the Kate Whittle side hustle and all the things that are happening. We're so excited for you, and we're all on board for you as well.
Thank you. And I've really loved having this opportunity to have a chat, because yeah, I've known you for a few years now, and I remember the first time we actually met face-to-face at a book launch here in Canberra, the new Harry Hartog, when it was first operational, yes.
Yes, yes. Yes, and you and I were sort of shuffled down into a little aisle and had a quick chat, didn't we?
We did.
Away from the main sort of event. Yeah.
That was lovely. And nice. Yeah. And I went home and that was it. I was in the duck pond from there.
Well, we will do it again now that the world's opening up. Definitely. It'll be really, really great.
We have to.
Yeah. All right, Kate, so this interview will go exclusively into the Duck Pond for a couple of weeks, so that everybody in there gets to just enjoy it as a premiere. And after that time, it will then be uploaded to YouTube as part of the In Conversation, Jen Storer In Conversation playlist on the Girl and Duck YouTube channel. And the audio will also be lifted from this and popped onto the Girl and Duck podcast as well. So there's lots of opportunities for people to enjoy this and get lots of treasures and glean lots of knowledge from
lovely.
It. Alrighty.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you, Kate, for inviting me along.
You're welcome.
Had a bit of fun. Probably talked too much.
Not at all. As I said, there was way more to say. We'll wind it up there, and I'll see you back in the duck pond.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kate. Take care.
Thank you.
Have a lovely day. Bye.
Love you too.
Bye-bye. Thanks for hanging out with me today. If you want more ducky goodness, pop over to the website www.girlandduck.com, or you can find me on Instagram at Jen E. Storer, J-E-N-E-S-T-O-R-E-R. Bye for now.